Good evening. It's February 22nd, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 20:31 hours Eastern Time. Ward Green with you again. Today's study, we're going to be starting the book of Hosea, which is a new book for our reading. We'll continue the book of 1 Chronicles. Yesterday's reading in Chronicles was somewhat of a repeat from 2 Samuel 5 and 5. Or 2 Samuel 5, the first part of that chapter of 2 Samuel. And today's study in the Crucible article, we're beginning chapter 7, which is called Abraham, His Place in History. And there's a quote there from the author David Peabody, 1841. A book called The Patriarch of Hebron, or The History of Abraham, page 24. Here he says, "The doctrine of divine revelation, by which God has made himself known to men, though in one view mysterious, is nevertheless extremely reasonable. It is only the condescension of a father adopting some unusual expedients to make himself known in the fullness of his benevolent heart to his ignorant and erring children." The word fullness there is spelled in an archaic way, not in the modern spelling. "What can be more reasonable," he goes on, "than this? He who denies the reasonableness of this must believe either that God has in his nature more of the tyrant than the father, or that he cannot go beyond the common range of nature's laws in manifesting his paternal character to his creatures." He's talking about miracles and ways in which God communicated with his servants in years past. And there are many today who believe that God doesn't perform miracles anymore, of course, but there are also those who do believe that he performs miracles, and there are those who witness miracles, such as medical miracles where healings occur and things like that. That is, there are doctors who've testified regarding the occurrence of miracles. Sometimes things just don't have an explanation as to why somebody is healed. Not according to the explanations of humans, but of course all things are possible with God, as our Lord Jesus said. Now, little children, if we begin reading chapter 7, paragraph 1, the continuous account of the Bible provides much insight, and we determine the birth of Abraham as 2206 BCE, a date based on the assessment of all of the biblical chronology. This was a very thorough assessment, I might add, to determine the year of birth of Abraham. Continuing our reading, as mentioned in the historical notes, which is a section of the article Joseph and Own, the time when Jehovah punished Sodom and Gomorrah by making it rain fire and sulfur upon these cities, see Genesis 19, verse 24, is confirmed by the dating of a meteorite storm. Look at this. Yeah, I was just seeing something, if I could see anything that I could learn from this. Yeah, I see the numbers there add up. Or subtract, rather, interestingly, confirmed by the dating of a meteorite storm to the time of 2200 to 2000 BCE. This is absolutely, it's just mind-boggling. How can it be that the time that we date Abraham is confirmed by the dating of a meteorite storm to 2200 to 2000 BCE, which was the time when Sodom and Gomorrah had fire and sulfur raining from heaven? Okay, Now, the date of Sodom and Gomorrah, therefore, is confirmed by the dating of a meteorite storm, except that the event, the witness, was Abraham, and the event was witnessed, well, there were other people like Lot. Lot witnessed it firsthand. The event was witnessed in Abraham's day, near his 100th year. The Bible tells us that. It was about, Abraham was about 100 years old, or 90, you know, older than 99 years old and less than 100 years old. The time of Abraham coincides. I mean, this is just a restatement of this fact. The time of Abraham coincides with the dating of meteorite showers. That's important because it explains Sodom and Gomorrah. And the sentence goes on, when Jehovah made it rain fire and sulfur on the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. But in what other ways do we find historical confirmation of the life of the patriarch? And that's what this chapter is going to be about. Abraham and his place in history as confirmed by scientific research. And it's quite remarkable, even having just read the first few paragraphs to myself today, I recall some of the ways in which I was completely astounded by the research that I discovered when I looked for it. But you see, if I didn't have the genealogy, if I hadn't discovered the date of the birth of Abraham or calculated it from the Bible chronology and from the other evidence, everything together to arrive at this date for Abraham, I would not have known where to look in history for the meteorite showers. I wouldn't have known what time in history, you know, like you could search on Google, you can't just say when was there a meteorite. You can't just say when was there a meteor or a meteorite shower that struck the earth without saying what time period you're looking for. You have to know the time at which you're looking for these things. Otherwise, you won't find it. That's why the chronology is so crucial, and that's why it's the crucible that actually determines whether the history makes sense. That's why this article is called The Crucible of Credible Creed. So Ecclesiastes 5 and 6 is our scripture for today, little children, from the Proverbs of Solomon. Do not allow your mouth to cause your flesh to sin. Neither say before the angel that it was a mistake. Why should the true God become indignant on account of your voice and have to wreck the work of your hands? And none of what we learn from the Bible is something that I'm teaching. It's what the Bible teaches. In trying to get other people's opinions about what the Bible means is rather useless, I think, if we don't accept what the Bible says itself and just read what it says. We can attempt to translate it and improve the translation, but after that, I mean, obviously it helps. It does help in the interpretation of some prophecies to consult people who know about how history unfolded and who have correlated the prophecies such as those in the book of Daniel with the historical kingdoms, like that kingdom of Alexander the Great, for example, which was a great kingdom and which was mentioned in the book of Daniel as the kingdom of Greece, but at the time of Daniel, Alexander did not exist. He had not been born, and he was not mentioned by name, whereas Cyrus had been mentioned by name by the prophet Isaiah before the Persian and the Median kingdom, that of the Medes and Persians, even came into existence. Cyrus had been named by Isaiah. But anyway, do not allow your mouth to cause your flesh to sin, neither say before the angel that it was a mistake. So it's, we can sin by our actions, but we can also sin by our words. And the other thing is, we shouldn't be saying and bothering to take time regarding admitting mistakes, it says here. Not before the angel. Why should the true God become indignant? You don't want God to know about admissions of your mistakes, is what that seems to be saying. Because God will come and wreck your own work. He'll wreck the work of your hands. So it's not about admitting mistakes. It's about, in this case, it's talking about vows. We can't make a vow and then say, well, that was a mistake. Right? It's okay to admit a mistake that, you know, of any kind, except for this. When we take a vow, we can't say, oh, that was a mistake. I didn't mean to vow that. If you vow something, you have to fulfill your vow. You have to fulfill the vows that you make. So, yeah, it's not wrong to admit a mistake generally, but, I mean, it's important to admit mistakes when we do make mistakes and to correct them. You can't correct it if you won't admit that you did something wrong, but in this case, you have to note the context of the previous verse there to get the right meaning. It's about vows, right? Okay. 1 Chronicles 12. And these are the ones that came to David at Ziklag while he was still under restrictions because of Saul the son of Kish. And they were among the mighty men, the helpers in the warfare, armed with the bow, using the right hand and using the left hand with stones or with arrows in the bow. They were of the brothers of Saul of Benjamin. There was the head Ahiezer and Joash, the sons of Shemaiah, the Gibeathite, and Jeziel and Pelet, the sons of Azmaveth, and Berekah and Jehu, the Anathothite. We're going to see the name Jehu, but meaning a different Jehu, the king of Israel, mentioned in Hosea chapter 1, in that reading today, as long as we get that far. And Ishmaiah, the Gibeonite, a mighty man among the 30 and over the 30, and Jeremiah, and Jehaziel, and Johanan, and Jozabad, the Gederathite, Eluzai, and Jeremoth, and Bealiah, and Shemariah, and Shephatiah, the Harifite, Elkanah, and Ishiah, and Azarel, and Joezer, and Jeshobeam, the Korahites, and Joelah and Zebediah, the sons of Jeroham of Gedor. And there were some of the Gadites that separated themselves to David's side at the place difficult to approach in the wilderness, valiant mighty men, army men for the war, keeping the large shield and the lance ready, whose faces were the faces of lions, and they were like the gazelles upon the mountains for speed. Ezer was the head, Obadiah the second, Eliab the third, Mishmanah the fourth, Jeremiah the fifth, Attai the sixth, Eliel the seventh, Johanan the eighth, Elzabad the ninth, Jeremiah the tenth, Machbanai the 11th. These were of the sons of Gad, heads of the army. The least one was equal to 100, and the greatest to 1,000. These are the ones that crossed the Jordan in the first month, when it was overflowing all its banks. And they then chased away all those of the low plains to the east and to the west. Now keep in mind the numbers of these people. When it gives the number of them, in terms of, it hasn't done so yet, but when we see the number, we realize these are the men of the army, so you can multiply that number by 4 or 5 or more, or maybe at least, obviously at least double, because they probably have wives. But then 3, 4, 5 times when you consider the children, and maybe more than that, depending on how many children each one has. So these numbers show how many people lived in Israel at that time. And it shows how small the exiles were in terms of how many people Nebuchadnezzar took, as documented in Jeremiah chapter 52, verses 28 through 30. And some of the sons of Benjamin and Judah proceeded to come clear to the place difficult to approach, to David. Then David went out before them and answered and said to them, "If it is for peace that you have come to help me, that you've come to me to help me, my own heart will become at unity with you." He said to the sons of Benjamin and Judah, "But if it is to betray me to my adversaries, when there is no wrong on my palms, let the God of our forefathers see to it and set it in order. And spirit itself enveloped Amasai, the head of the 30. Yours we are, O David, and with you we are, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace be yours, and peace to the one helping you, for your God has helped you." So David received them and put them among the heads of the troops. And there were some of Manasseh that deserted to David when he came with the Philistines against Saul for battle. We read about that. But he did not help them, for on counsel the access lords of the Philistines sent him away, saying, "At the risk of our own heads, he will desert to his lord Saul." When he came to Ziklag, there deserted to him from Manasseh Adnah and Jozabad and Jediael and Michael and Jozabad and Elihu and Zilethai. Heads of the thousands that belonged to Manasseh, and they for their part were of help to David against the marauder band, because all of them were mighty men of valor, and they came to be chiefs in the army. There was a marauder band. You remember that David, when he went back to his place where he was living in Ziklag, there had been an invasion by a marauder band, and these men helped him because all of them were mighty men of valor, and they came to be chiefs in the army. For day by day, people kept coming to David to help him until it was a great camp like the camp of God. And of course, this occurrence when he came to Ziklag, this event was from 1 Samuel 30 and verse 1. The marauder band was of the Amalekites that had come and invaded. Now, continuing our reading in 1 Chronicles 12, and these were the numbers, verse 23, of the heads of those equipped for the army that came to David at Hebron to turn the kingship of Saul over to him according to Jehovah's order. The sons of Judah carrying the large shield and the lance were 6,800 equipped for the army. So we can multiply that number by, it's about 7,000 multiplied by 4 would be 28,000 people living in Judah, or perhaps more or less. Of the sons of Simeon, the mighty men of valor, they also lived in Judah, though. Of the army were 7,100. So again, multiplied by 4, 28,000 people added on to the ones we just mentioned. And of the Levites, they also lived in Judah, did they not? I'm trying to think where else they lived other than Judah. They must have lived in. I think some of the Levites lived in other places other than Judah, perhaps. But of the Levites, their sons, 4,600. So you see how many, the total is getting to be 56, maybe 70,000 people living in Judah, just of these tribes, right? And Jehoiada was the leader of the sons of Aaron. And with him, this is another group. There were 3,700. They lived likely in Judah. Also, Zadok, 3,700 times 4 would be more than 12,000 people added to our 70,000. So we're already up to about 80,000 people. Also, Zadok, a young man, mighty in valor in the house of his forefathers, 22 chiefs. 22 chiefs. He was a priest of the sons of Aaron. And of the sons of Benjamin, the brothers of Saul, there were 3,000. And up till then, the greater number of them were keeping strict watch of the house of Saul. And of the sons of Ephraim, there were 20,800. Wow, it's a lot when you multiply that by some number like 3 or 4 or 5. Mighty men of valor, men of fame by the house of their forefathers. And of the half tribe of Manasseh, there were 18,000 that had been designated by name to come to make David king. 18,000 again times 4 is 72,000. And of the sons of Issachar, having a knowledge of how to discern the times, to know what Israel ought to do, there were 200 head ones of theirs, and all their brothers were at their orders. When it doesn't know the number of them, it gives the number of the head ones. Of Zebulun, those going out to the army, drawing up in battle formation with all the weapons of war, there were 50,000, which makes about 200,000 people living in that area, and in that tribal territory. And for flocking together to David, they were not of a double heart. They were very committed, in other words. And of Naphtali, there were 1,000 chiefs, and with them, with the large shield and the spear, there were 37,000. Multiply that by 4 would be like almost 160,000, 40,000 times 4. And of the Danites, those drawing up in battle formation were 28,600. Again, 30,000 times 4 would be 120,000 people, including women and children. And of Asher, those going out to the army for drawing up in battle formation were 40,000, which is 160,000 if it's multiplied by 4. And from across the Jordan of the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, with all the weapons of the military army, there were 120,000. The Reubenites and Gadites, that's just the army. 4 times that would be 480,000. About 500,000 people. All these were men of war flocking together in battle line with a complete heart. They came to Hebron to make David king over all Israel. No, it's not necessarily that all of these 120,000 came to Hebron, but it sounds like it from that. And also all the remainder of Israel were of one heart for making David king. And they continued there with David 3 days, eating and drinking, for their brothers had made preparation for them. And also those near to them, as far as Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali, were bringing food upon asses and upon camels and upon mules and upon cattle, eatables of flour, cakes of pressed figs and cakes of raisins, and wine and oil and cattle and sheep in great quantity, for there was rejoicing in Israel when David was made king. That's the end of 1 Chronicles chapter 12. Hosea chapter 1. The word of Jehovah that occurred to Hosea, this is a very short chapter, as are most of the chapters in the minor prophets. We're beginning to read the minor prophets now, little ones. Hosea is a minor prophet. His book is not so lengthy. That's why they're considered minor prophets. Not that they're minor in their message, or their importance is not minor, but the length of the book is minor. The word of Jehovah that occurred to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Uzziah was also known as Azariah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, the king of Israel. To get the time period for that, in the Moses Part 2 article, Azariah began to rule in 810 in the genealogy, and Hezekiah in 725, so that's the time period. And Hezekiah's rule ended in 696. but Azariah ended in 758. So the minimum number of years of preaching there is 758 to 725, which is 33 years, or 32 years from 757, minimum for the preaching work of Hosea. And Jeroboam II reigned from 826 to 785, so that includes 785 being after the beginning of Azariah, or as he's also known, Uzziah. Therefore, Azariah's reign since Jeroboam, he ended in 785, we have to take 785 as the beginning of the preaching work at the minimum, at least, if not earlier than that, and therefore 785, which is 60 years until Hezekiah. So the preaching work of this prophet Hosea is at least 60 years that he preached. There was a start of the word of Jehovah by Hosea, and Jehovah proceeded to say to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of fornication and children of fornication, because by fornication the land positively turns from following Jehovah. Fornication, in the footnote below here, it says prostitutions. In the King James, I think it's called whoredoms. But let's take a look and see what it says in the Study Bible. A woman of prostitution and children of prostitution, because the land has turned completely away from following Jehovah, in the Study Bible. And he proceeded to go and take Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, so that she became pregnant and in time bore to him a son. And Jehovah went on to say to him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I must hold an accounting for the acts of bloodshed of Jezreel against the house of Jehu, who was a king. And the kings of Israel lived in Jezreel, and the capital was Samaria, in the northern kingdom of Israel. And I must cause the royal rule of the house of Israel to cease, and it must occur in that day that I must break the bow of Israel in the low plain of Jezreel. And she proceeded to become pregnant another time and to give birth to a daughter. And he went on to say to him, call her name Loruhamah, which means she was not shown mercy. By the way, the word lo in Hebrew means no. So it's no, the negative of whatever follows. For I shall no more show mercy again to the house of Israel, because I shall positively take them away. But to the house of Judah I shall show mercy. And we know shortly after the days of the beginning of Hezekiah's reign, shortly after that, Samaria was conquered by Assyria and Israel was taken into exile. But not during Hosea's lifetime, or during the time of his preaching. But it was prophesied by him right here. But to the house of Judah, though, even though he was going to take Israel away, as prophesied here, I shall show mercy to Judah, and I will save them by Jehovah their God, but I shall not save them by a bow, or by a sword, or by war, by horses, or by horsemen. And she gradually weaned Loruhamah, the daughter, and she proceeded to become pregnant and give birth to a son. So he said, call his name Loami, which again begins with the word no, or lo. Loami means not my people. Ami being, of course, the French word for friend. So no friend is what that name essentially means. Is one way to define that, to understand it. But Loruhamah, I didn't show that down here. Let's show it below. There's the name, the definition of Loruhamah. She was not shown mercy. Lo meaning not or no. And Loami, with Loami meaning not my people. Yeah, I think you can see that. Okay. hopefully. So he said, call his name Lo-Ammi, because you men are not my people, and I myself shall prove to be not yours. And the number of the sons of Israel must become like the grains of the sand of the sea that cannot be measured or numbered. And it must occur that in the place in which it used to be said to them, you men are not my people, it will be said to them, the sons of the living God. So even though he was telling Hosea, who was in the northern kingdom, was he not? Or was he? Let me see. I don't know how I got that impression, but... because he was of the tribe of Reuben, according to Mr. Adam Clark, the commentator. I read some comment in this book that said he was of the tribe of Reuben. If he was of the tribe of Reuben, then he'd be in the northern kingdom. But even though he said that these kingdoms of Israel and Judah were no longer his people, they were going to become like the grains of sand of the sea, and it was going to be said they were sons of the living God, and the sons of Judah, verse 11, and the sons of Israel will certainly be collected into a unity, and will actually set up for themselves one head and go up out of the land, because great will be the day of Jezreel. So Jezreel, you see, that's the northern kingdom. And they will be collected together, Judah and Israel, both, according to the prophecy here of Hosea, however we pronounce it, Jezreel will have a great day. That's a prophecy, even though he, in this same chapter, the prophet Hosea prophesied calamity for both Israel and Judah, and yet the same chapter ends with a very positive note that they would be collected together, they would be God's children. So there we go. That's the end of our study for today and our video. I enjoy the studies. They're very difficult. You know, it's not difficult to do one, but to do studies day after day after day after day, it's difficult to see where the, you know, what the importance is until I actually do it. After I've done the study, yeah, I can see that this was important. This study was important. It was significant. Even, especially I have a lot of belief in the Crucible article and in the chronology of the genealogy too. That I know is going to be good no matter what. It's always important. If and when you believe about it, the chronology matters, which of course it does, because you can't study history without knowing where to look in that history. Anyway, that's it. We just about run over time. It's February 22nd, 2024 of the Common Era, 2105 Eastern Time. Ward Green saying, I love you. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.